The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Runes, the 2018 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2018. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
All right, well, welcome, good afternoon. It is the afternoon of the last full day of the conference, right? So we're all trying to stay awake. So we did get the lights turned on. That's a good thing. Thank you for being here today. I'm sorry that I'm so far away from you. I don't think we can move these. No, we can't. It's taped down, and we need the mic for recording purposes. So I'll stay here, and we'll be fine. This is the formative power of educational metaphors. I do have this handout. The outline is in your book as well, but I'll just pass these back. If you want to use the book, it's on page 160 and 161 of the conference book. Okay, also before we get started, I do just want to make a plug for Classical Academic Press and a book series that they have over there called Giants in the History of Education. Right now there are 4 volumes in that book. We are continuing to produce more. There's another one that should be just about ready to go to print. So far we have one on Plato, the Greek philosopher Plato, that I wrote, one on C.S. Lewis that Lou Marcos wrote, who's here, one on John Milton that Grant Horner wrote, who also is here, and another one on Jonimus Comenius that David Smith up at Calvin College wrote. And then we have one that's just about ready to come out on Augustine by Jeff Lehman up at Hillsdale. So encourage you to check those out. They're great introductory volumes for these thinkers, their thought on education. They're great for, you know, teacher training or just to learn a little bit about these figures and their philosophy of education. Even if you're not an expert in it, that's fine. Okay, what we're going to look at today is metaphor. And you can see on your outline there, I'm going to discuss 3 key metaphors. And then we're going to spend some time asking some questions about how these things are useful and inform what we do. So let me just start by making the point that metaphors are powerful tools that profoundly affect how we think and live. Metaphor is not just something that we teach students in a writing class, or, you know, if you're an author, you need it, or something like that. All of us every day rely on metaphors to understand and interpret our experiences and the world around us. I'm going to read an extended quote here by means of introduction by a book called Metaphors We Live by Lakoff and Johnson. They say this: metaphor is pervasive in everyday life, not just in language, but in thought and action. Our ordinary conceptual system, in terms of which we both think and act, is fundamentally metaphorical in nature. The concepts that govern our thought are not just matters of the intellect. They also govern our everyday functioning, down to the most mundane details. Our concepts structure what we perceive, how we get around in the world, and how we relate to other people. Our conceptual system thus plays a central role in defining our everyday realities. If we are right in suggesting that our conceptual system is largely metaphorical, then the way we think, what we experience, and what we do every day is much a matter of metaphor. End quote. Okay, now, the issue of how exactly language and thought and perception interact is complicated, and there's a long tradition of professional scholarship on that and philosophical debate about how our language affects our thoughts and our perceptions affects our thoughts and, you know, make all the connections, okay? We're not going to get too deep into that today, but regardless of exactly how we understand that relationship, it seems clear that metaphor plays a key role in how we think, perceive, and communicate. So let me give you one example before we jump into talking about education. Think about all the ways that our language about the concept of an argument is based on the metaphor of war. Okay? Here are a few examples. Your claims are indefensible. He attacked every weak point in my argument. His criticisms were right on target. I demolished his argument. I've never won an argument with him. You disagree? Okay, shoot. If you use that strategy, he'll wipe you out. He shot down all my arguments. Okay, all of those phrases we use to talk about arguments. Okay, those are very, but they're all based on a certain understanding of what an argument is that's grounded in really a metaphor of war or battle. Okay, so we talk about arguments in terms of winning and losing. The people involved in an argument are opponents, and we attack each other's positions. We defend our own. We plan and use strategies. When our position becomes indefensible, we can fall back or abandon it and take a new line of attack. An argument is structured by attacks, defenses, counterattacks, shooting down the opponent's ideas and arguments, etc., etc. Okay? So you may say, well, how else could we think about what an argument is? Let me just give you an alternative metaphor. What if we thought of an argument in terms of a dance? Okay, so we think about argument by the metaphor of a dance. The participants are performers. The goal is to perform in a balanced and aesthetically pleasing way. Nobody wins or loses. Nobody attacks or defends. Rather, each performer takes turns leaning on the strengths of the other. And they share a common goal of discovering truth instead of being opponents. Now, that language sounds funny, right? We don't usually talk about arguments that way, but it would make a lot of sense and actually probably is more in line with what we want our students or our own children to achieve as they're having arguments, right? We have four children. My two daughters, who are 8 and 11 right now, were having a heated argument the other day that we had to sort of tamp down because it was getting so, you know, emotional on both sides. And it was over something relatively silly, which made it kind of all the funnier, right? They weren't like, you know, discussing the afterlife or the ontological status of, you know, human beings or anything. So it was this silly little thing. But my wife and I kept saying, whoa. Like, the goal here is not to win, right? You've heard what she said. You've heard what she said. Learn from each other's positions. Think about it. And you know, continue to have dialogue in a respectful way that helps you to come to a fuller understanding of this issue. Right? That's the goal. Okay, so the point is, though, that we talk about argument in a certain way because we conceive of argument in that way, and we act according to how we conceive of things. So the metaphors we use, in other words, shape how we think about various practices, like arguing, for example, or educating, and hence how we engage in those practices. Okay, now, throughout the history of education, a lot of metaphors have been used to describe what education is about. Okay, there are a lot of them. And those metaphors have had a formative impact on educational theory and practice. Here are just a few, okay, metaphors that have been used to describe education. A museum, a cathedral, a banquet, a monastery, a beehive, a road. Okay, and there are others. I'll mention some more at the end. What I'm going to do today, in this time we have together, is I'm going to examine three important educational metaphors throughout history, the history of education, and consider some of the educational implications that follow from them. Okay, and the three metaphors that I'm going to look at in a little bit of depth are Plato's cave, the metaphor of the cave, or the allegory of the cave, the industrial factory, and third, a guided journey. Okay. And then, like I said, I'll throw out a few others at the end, and then I want to have some time for discussion. I have a few questions, and maybe you'll have questions as well, that we can sort of use as a jumping-off point to think about this a little bit and think through what we do on a day-to-day basis or a class-by-class basis or a year-by-year basis. Okay, so my analysis here is certainly not meant to be exhaustive, but what I'm trying to do is facilitate further conversation and offer a compelling case that we should carefully consider the explicit and implicit metaphors that guide and limit our educational thought and practice. Okay, and then at the end, as I said, we can talk through a few of the practical implications. So let me start with looking at Plato's cave, this first very important metaphor. How many of you have read the perhaps most famous educational metaphor in all of the history of the Western tradition with the allegory of the cave? How many have read Plato's allegory of the cave? Okay, a few of you. Let me just briefly explain. It's not that long. Here's how it goes. This is if you haven't, you should go look it up. It's at the beginning of Book 7 at the Republic. It's only a couple pages long. Okay, he says, look, imagine that there were a group of human beings in a cave. They live in a cave, and since birth, they've been chained, they've been bound fast, such that they can only look in one direction, okay? So they're chained up in this cave, and they can only face the wall, okay, this wall in front of them. And way behind these prisoners, there's a fire, all right? And between the fire and their backs, there's this low wall, okay? So the fire is casting light onto the, I'll do it this way so it makes sense to you. The fire behind is casting light up onto the wall in front of them. They're all bound, facing the same direction, much like you are right now, much like some of our students are in our classrooms with rows of desks, for example, okay? And then what happens is with this wall, artifacts are held up behind this wall so the prisoners can see what? Can they see the artifacts? No, what can they see? The shadows. All they see is the shadows on the wall. Okay, so we could do this, right? I always do this with students. Set up a projector or something. You pass objects in front, right? Except it doesn't work here because this should be behind you, right? So if this were behind you, you couldn't see it. You can. If you ever go through this with students, do this. Okay. Set up a projector, right? And then pass different objects in front of it and see if they can guess what they are. And it's pretty fun because you can just have a good time with it. And it illustrates exactly what's going on here. Okay, so they have contests, right? Who can guess which shadow is coming next? And the point is, they think that those shadows is all that's real. They've never actually seen the objects. Okay, so what would happen, Plato asks, if one of these unfortunate prisoners were to be freed? Somehow he's freed from these bonds. And at first, he'd be dazzled. He turns around, he sees the fire. It wouldn't make any sense. Okay, this would be this completely weird thing. He goes up out of the cave, and his eyes, what would happen to his eyes? Would he be able to see things immediately? Why not? Because he's been in the darkness his whole life, right? So the light would blind his eyes, and then gradually he'd be able to see objects, and finally he would be able to look up and see the sun, which is the source of the light that illuminates all these objects, okay? So there would be this process. Now, if he goes back down into the cave to finish out this allegory, first of all, he would realize, oh, these shadows aren't the real things, right? They're just reflections of the real things. There's this whole other realm of reality that none of us chained up in the cave knew about. We thought that was all there was. There's this whole other level of reality, okay? So he would be able to see things as they truly are, not merely the images of the shadows. And he would think back to his poor, you know, fellow prisoners down in the cave. And he would want to go rescue them. So he goes down into the cave. And what happens as his eyes are now accustomed to the light? He goes back into the darkness. Can he see the shadows super well? No. Okay. So in a cruel twist of fate, all the other prisoners say, well, this worthless fellow, right? He went up and he's trying to tell us that there's more out there, but he, you know, it's blinded him. He's useless. He can't even guess which shadows are going to pass in front, right? So they judge him based on their limited understanding of reality. And Plato says, if he tries to free them, they will kill him, okay? He will not be able to win the prizes for guessing which shadow comes next, okay? Because his eyes won't have readjusted. Okay, now this has so many implications, okay? So for example, talk to your students about why they prefer shadow friendships instead of real friendships, right? The screen provides this fantastic modern model of Plato's cave. The shadows on the wall, you're engaging in a world that is a shadow. It's a reflection. It's not really real, right? But people have friends through it. They engage in reality through it. Their social status is dictated by it. And oftentimes, if somebody chooses not to play the game because they've realized that there's more out there, right? They've realized that their self-worth comes from being a son or daughter of God, for example, they're ridiculed and cast out. Because they can't play the game right, okay? So there's all kinds of fantastic things that you can draw from this allegory, okay? There are you know, political, social, epistemological, theological implications, okay? But here's the thing: in the Republic, Plato, and a lot of people don't realize this, Plato treats this allegory of the cave primarily as an educational metaphor. So he starts the whole thing by saying this. He charges his listeners to, quote, compare the effect of education and of the lack of it on our own nature to an experience like this, end quote. And then he goes on to give this allegory. Okay, and is immediately at the end of this allegory, he draws a series of educational conclusions. He contends that the power to learn is like sight in that it's present in every person. So he says, education isn't what some people declare it to be, namely putting knowledge into souls that lack it, like putting sight into blind eyes. Rather, he views education as a process of conversion in which students turn their souls from the shadows of this world to the form of the good. Okay, so the whole point of education, he's saying, is to help students realize that what they think is real is not really that real. There's more stuff out there that's more real. Okay? So this in this kind of conversion, the entire soul is changed. Plato explains, quote, the instrument with which each learns is like an eye that cannot be turned around from darkness to light without turning the whole body. This instrument cannot be turned around from that which is coming into being without turning the whole soul until it is able to study that which is and the brightest thing that is, namely, the one we call the good, end quote. Okay? And again, Plato was pre-Christ, he was a pagan, but do you see how he's so close, right, to the special revelation of Christ and the gospel? What we need is for someone to come into the darkness of our world of shadows and free us and lead us up into the light. The people walking in the shadows, right, have seen a great light. Okay, to lead us up into the light by a process of conversion in which our entire soul is reoriented, and we then realize that there's a higher reality that we didn't even know existed. And we come out and ultimately are able to look at the sun, which is the source of our ability to perceive all things. Okay, he's so close. Okay? There's all these great implications. Okay, so in terms of education, according to this first metaphor then, the role of teachers is not to transfer knowledge to their students or to equip them with the ability to learn. Rather, the teacher's role is to facilitate a kind of conversion experience in which students turn from the shadows of this world to the form of the good. And Plato concludes, based on the allegory of the cave, that education is, quote, the craft concerned with doing this very thing, this turning around, and with how the soul can most easily and effectively be made to do it. It isn't the craft of putting sight into the soul. Education takes for granted that the sight is there, but that it isn't turned the right way or looking where it ought to look and tries to redirect it appropriately, end quote. So CDC Reeve explains that the fundamental goal of education, according to Plato then, is not to put knowledge into people's souls, but to change their desires, thereby turning them around from the pursuit of what they falsely believed to be happiness. Note also that it follows from this metaphor that education is often necessarily a painful process for students as their eyes adjust to new perspectives and realities that may completely undermine what they once comfortably believed and held to be valuable. Okay? As you walk up out of this cave in which you've lived your whole life, and your eyes are overwhelmed by the bright light of this sun, it hurts, okay? And it's uncomfortable, and it takes a while to be able to perceive things correctly. Or to put it into more contemporary terms, the student who is accustomed to reading celebrity magazines and Twitter feeds may initially find the profound insights of Homer, Augustine, or Shakespeare to be a little bit overwhelming and difficult to grasp and appreciate, okay? That's okay. That's a normal part of the learning process. And throughout the Western tradition, as I close out this metaphor of the cave, throughout the Western tradition, there is a long history of people sort of riffing off of this idea. Think Augustine and the ordering of the loves, right? His treatment of, so Plato's saying, we have sight. Augustine says, we have desires. The question is, what are we desiring? Do we desire the good things, right? A pithy little quote you can always talk through with students is Augustine when he said, love and do what you will, right? In other words, Why do we do bad things? Because we love the wrong things. If our loves were perfectly aligned, we could do whatever we wanted, right? So this is and James K. Smith up at Calvin has written a lot about this recently in terms of the role that liturgies play in this, right? Desiring the Kingdom and subsequent books, in terms of the way in which the desires, he argues, that we have are shaped and molded by the habit-forming practices in which we engage. Okay, so there's this long tradition of thinking about our desires and education in terms of the cave. Okay, second educational metaphor that has been very important throughout history and is probably the most relevant to us today, unfortunately. This is the metaphor of the industrial factory. Now, the metaphor of the industrial factory, unlike Plato's cave, did not originate from a writer's pen. Okay? But rather from the multifaceted industrial revolution that took place from the late 18th through the 19th centuries. And two particularly important aspects of the industrial factory that arose during this period were, number one, interchangeable parts, and number two, the assembly line. So let me just explain each of these very quickly, and then we will apply it to education. At the beginning of the 19th century, cotton gin inventor Eli Whitney championed the manufacture of interchangeable parts in the production of muskets at his armory. Now, before, how did you make a musket? You had a gunsmith, and this gunsmith was responsible for crafting each weapon. So he would make one at a time, right, and craft every part of it by hand from start to finish. And what Eli Whitney sort of realized was, if we make identical component pieces that are manufactured separately en masse, we can then assemble them together to form a complete musket. And obviously, this doesn't just apply to muskets. You can do, you know, almost anything. You can manufacture almost anything this way. Okay, so it had obvious benefits for both production and repairs. Both are faster, they're easier, they're cheaper. Okay, you have interchangeable parts. If one part breaks, you just put in a new one. Okay, it also meant that the necessary qualifications of workers were quite different. So no longer was each weapon produced by a sole craftsman who understood all the intimate connections between the parts. Okay, now you could have relatively unskilled groups of workers who could produce each part separately. It wasn't necessary for them to understand the assembly and proper function of the musket as a whole. And, you know, for example, it's quite possible to manufacture a given number of perfectly acceptable firing pins every day without understanding how the firing pin, you know, what role it plays in the whole musket, or even knowing how to connect it to the other parts of the firing mechanism, okay? All you have to know is how to make the firing pin. That's it. And if you've got 10 different people making 10 different parts, and then, you know, a few people just putting it all together, presto, you can produce these muskets, you know, like I said, faster, easier, and cheaper. Okay? Now, the second important aspect of the industrial factory was the assembly line, in addition to the interchangeable parts. And this idea was used and developed throughout the 19th century. It was famously, you know, quote unquote, perfected by the Ford Motor Company in the early 20th century for the production of Model T automobiles. And the basic concept behind an assembly line, as I'm sure we all know, is that the product being manufactured is assembled in discrete segments by workers who remain stationary along a production line. So each worker is responsible for performing a simple task over and over and over, while the other necessary tasks are simultaneously produced by workers at the different stations along the line. And like the concept of interchangeable parts, this has obvious benefits in terms of efficiency, right? You don't need as many tools because every worker doesn't need the whole set of tools necessary in the case of an automobile to put together the whole automobile. Any given worker only needs the necessary tools to do, you know, his simple function over and over and over and over. So you need fewer tools. The other thing is that as the products go down the line, each worker is doing the same task over and over and over and over. So this mastery of a simple repetitive task increases production speed and reduces errors. And also, as with the production of interchangeable parts, an assembly line requires relatively unskilled labor. Okay, so a worker can perform at any given station that can perform their job perfectly satisfactorily without having any idea of how to accomplish the other tasks necessary to assemble the entire automobile or tractor or whatever you're doing, or even understanding how their specific task contributes meaningfully to the assembly of the entire product. Right? They don't even have to understand why they're doing step 47 or how step 47, you know, station 47 sets up the object for what happens next in station 48 or 49. Okay? And as interchangeable parts and the assembly line became the accepted norm in factory production, the industrial factory gradually became the dominant metaphor by which to organize the process of education as well. Okay? As historian Paige Smith notes, by the final decades of the 19th century, education had come to be treated primarily as a, quote, knowledge industry. Okay, so education is an industry. What we're making is not automobiles, but knowledge. Okay. In the session I did yesterday on working out how to set up an upper school elective system, I was talking about the 19th century and some of the changes happening in education during the end of the 19th century, and read another quote in which somebody succinctly stated, education has, the college has ceased to become a cloister and has become a workshop. And so education was being viewed in terms of this industrial model. Now consider, for example, the daily and annual routines of both teachers and students in a post-industrial school. Okay, and this is going to sound strikingly familiar and close to home. The teacher, like the factory worker, became a specialist. So whereas before, a school teacher, often in a one-room schoolhouse, was responsible for crafting a small group of local students in various curricular subjects over the course of multiple years, teachers soon became responsible for a specific subject area or grade level, a higher degree of specialization. The algebra teacher might now teach period after period of algebra each day. Okay, think the factory worker, ka-chunk, 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 repeating the same lesson over and over, much like this factory worker who repeatedly performs the same task. The third grade teacher, similarly, is a specialist in teaching third grade and repeatedly performs this task year after year. And like the factory worker, the industrial teacher does not have to understand the end product. The algebra teacher can teach algebra perfectly well, it is assumed, without understanding how mathematics works alongside of history, literature, science, foreign languages, and fine arts, or how those things all together work to holistically form the student into a certain kind of person. Okay, likewise, the third grade teacher can teach third grade math, it's assumed, without needing to understand at all how the mathematical concepts being taught in third grade will later be developed and built upon to form students able to reason about higher mathematics or solve complicated calculus equations. Okay? One thing I did a couple years ago in our fall orientation with our faculty development time, was I had our high school math teacher come and work with the grammar teachers and take a few concepts that are, you know, very simple concepts mathematically that they teach in lower grammar grades and explain why a conceptual grasp of those concepts is so important when you get to trigonometry or precalculus or calculus, okay? And it opened their eyes to see what I'm doing here has huge implications a decade down the road, right? And how I do this, there are different ways I can go about teaching this concept that are going to be more or less beneficial for the student a decade down the road, okay? So that's just an example. Now, while teachers become akin to factory workers on this industrial factory metaphor, students in many ways parallel the products that roll off of an assembly line. So each day, think about what your students go through each day. Okay, in the upper school, they go from class to class, or in the grammar school, they go from subject to subject, just like partially assembled products rolling down a line. Period one is one station. Period two is another station. Period three is another station. And these discrete stations are divided into even intervals. They're usually governed by bells, which came out of the factory system, by the way. Okay? And as students are shuttled down the line, they encounter at each station a new worker who specializes in the assigned educational task for that period. Now, the metaphor of this assembly line station works not only in terms of daily periods, but on an annual scale as well. Student learning is divided into discrete grade levels through which students progress. And like products on an assembly line, students do not move on to the next grade level until the education of their current station has been successfully completed. Okay, so the entire enterprise of learning, both on a daily and annual basis, is conceived of not as a holistic, organic, continuous process, but as one that can be divided into this list of distinct standards or steps through which students must successfully and sequentially move. Okay? Sound familiar? All too familiar. Okay, finally, a guided journey. The third and final educational metaphor that I'd like to look at is that of a guided journey. And I think that this metaphor is probably, in many ways it challenges the previous metaphors, especially that of the industrial factory. And I think it may be particularly helpful for those of us who are working within a classical liberal arts paradigm of education. Okay, now this metaphor of a guided journey has cropped up multiple places throughout the history of education. You find it in university and guilds in the Middle Ages, Dante's use of Virgil in the Divine Comedy. The Latin roots of the very words we use to talk about education seem to point toward this metaphor. Okay, so very quickly, consider the Latin words used for teacher, student, and to educate. Okay, and there may be an etymological fallacy lurking here, but let's not worry about that too much right now. Okay, so there's still a point to be learned. What is the Latin word for teacher? Magister, which literally means, okay, or a master, okay? What's the Latin word for a student? Discipulus, from which we get the English word disciple. And what's the Latin word for to educate? Educere, which literally means to lead out, okay? So think about this. The teacher is a master, the disciple is a student, and the process of education is the master leading out the disciple. Okay, that's what the kind of metaphor that the etymology points to. Okay, this verb educere to lead out. We get lots of cognates from this. Okay, so the ducts carrying the air, right? They're leading the air from the AC unit somewhere right into this room. Okay, when you induct someone, we just add a bunch of prefixes, right? When you induct somebody into National Honor Society or whatever, you are leading them into, right? You're bringing them into a society. When you abduct a child, right? You're leading them away, okay, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Conduct, a wire conducts electricity by carrying the wire along, or carrying the electricity, the electrons along the wire, et cetera, okay? Okay, now, the teacher, by this metaphor, is a kind of guide, okay, who's been down the trail before, so to speak, and uses insights gained by past journeys to lead his followers down the path. So think about a trail guide. Hey, watch out for that plant that has three leaves and is red. Okay? Don't sit in it or blow your nose with it, for example. That would not be smart. I know, I did it once. Okay? That's the guide, the person leading the other people down the trail. We're going to come to a fork in the road up here. How do we know which way we should go? Well, let's get out your compasses. Okay, which way are we trying to go? Right? There's this process by which the guide helps the students learn to navigate the trail. Okay? It leads them along and demonstrates for them how to do it. Okay, another example of this guided journey is the relationship that exists between a master tradesman and an apprentice. So consider, for example, a blacksmith who takes a young boy into his shop in order to guide him toward mastery. You could do it with any other craft as well. I'm just picking a blacksmith. So the master craftsman serves as a guide for this novice by allowing the boy to observe him at work and by giving the apprentice some simple tasks that he too can accomplish despite his limited experience. Okay, so again, note, while on a day-to-day basis, the master may be creating, a beautiful wrought iron piece of art while the apprentice is bending horseshoes or stoking the fire, in a fundamental sense, they're both about the same business, Right? They're engaging in an activity together, going towards something. Like the trail guide and his followers, both are traveling together along the same path. The blacksmith leads his disciples along the journey of becoming a master by guiding him through steps that he has taken many times in the past and by modeling for him how those steps should be done. Okay, art studios, historically, have worked this way as well. Now, here's one example of this. If you're a math teacher, one of the things that you can do is to help your students not only to learn the concepts, but to learn how to think mathematically. Okay? So one of the most, to my mind, destructive ways of going about math education is to put a problem on the board and say, okay, here's how you solve this kind of problem. Copy my work. Okay, there's some benefit to that. Their students are copying. Here's another kind of problem that'll be on the homework tonight. Here's how you do this one. Okay, the problem is that half the battle for the students when they go home to do their homework or they're sitting in front of the test is not can I do the process, but which process do I do, right? And especially as you get into higher math, a large percentage of what they need to do, when you're attacking a calculus problem, for example, a huge portion of doing it successfully is figuring out what tools do I have in my kit that I can apply to this to get from what I know to what I'm trying to accomplish or trying to know. See? So model that for them. How do we, okay, what are we going to do? What do we see here? What, given what we already know, what can we tell about this problem? What could we do with this? Is there something here that we haven't seen before? How might we navigate that? Okay? That's just one example. Okay? You could come up with examples for other things. Okay. So according to this metaphor of a guided journey, the teacher is a master who's leading students along this path of learning. John Milton Gregory writes in the Seven Laws of Teaching, quote, "It is the teacher's mission to stand at the impassable gateway of young souls, a wiser and stronger soul than they, to guide them to the paths to be trodden," end quote. And it's worth noting that in order for this metaphor of the educational process to make sense, the teacher and student must be facing in the same direction and moving toward the same goal. Of course, in a physical sense, the teacher may be at the front of the classroom facing the students, or maybe not. Okay? But in an important conceptual sense, teachers don't face students in order to direct the teaching process at them, but rather face the same direction as the students, a few paces ahead in their own journey of learning, in order to guide students toward a common goal. So, for example, the teacher has read through the book before, shares insights gained by past readings to help students navigate the work. Okay, you know what? What you're saying about this character, I thought that also the first time I read through this book. Okay. But I want you to think about that point in light of the chapter we're going to read tonight, because it may change your view. Okay. I first interpreted the author as saying that as well. Okay. But then I remembered. Remember back in chapter 2? Now the students didn't remember. That was last week. Remember, we need to go back and think about what we did last week, right? Because that's going to inform what we're doing. So last night I spent some time going back over what we did last week in preparation for this class, and I realized that what we're talking about today is really informed by, okay, see what I'm saying? You're modeling it for them, okay? You're modeling, you're teaching them how to learn. A final important implication of this metaphor is that as master learners guiding students on this path of learning, teachers serve as exemplars of what students ought to become. Thus, in a fundamental way, and this is a huge point, the teacher is the text, and an essential characteristic of teachers is that they themselves model the same approach to learning that we seek to cultivate in our students. Okay? Our students are not only learning content from us, they're learning how to learn. If you never come into class excited about a book you've been reading, or something you figured out, or a new way to solve the equation that you discovered last night, you're not going to communicate to your students an excitement about or a love of learning. Okay? We model for our students what it means to be a learner. Arthur Holmes writes In his book, The Idea of a Christian College, quote, "The most important single factor in the teacher is the attitude toward learning. By virtue of what a teacher is, his students can stand on his shoulders and peer further in their day than he did in his." So in other words, according to the metaphor of a guided journey, what it means to be a good teacher has more to do with being a certain kind of person and learner than with producing a certain set of measurable results. See the key difference? The question isn't how many widgets can you turn out in a day? The question is, did the product on the assembly line become more like you? To mix metaphors. Okay? So to conclude, Plato's Cave, the Industrial Factory, and a Guided Journey, these are just three metaphors, okay, that I've looked at a little bit today. There are other metaphors that deserve similar analysis. Okay, here are a few others in the history of education that have significant educational implications. Socrates' appropriation of midwifery. Okay, so in the Platonic dialogue, Socrates continually says that he's not giving birth to new knowledge, he's simply a midwife, helping others give birth to their own knowledge. There's a lot that we could say there in terms of the educational implications of that. Comenius, John Amos Comenius, talks about the school as a garden of delight, okay, a place of discovery where children are delighted by the butterflies and the flowers, okay, and the grammar markings and the sentence diagramming and the algebraic formulas and but it's a garden of delight. That's the model. Compare Locke's Tabula Rasa with Rousseau's treatment of children as plants. Okay, those two metaphors had a huge impact. Okay, for multiple centuries after Locke and Rousseau, they're completely different. Right, if you think of a child as a blank sheet of paper and the job of the teacher is to write things on it. Okay, that is a completely different approach to education than thinking of the child as a plant that will grow on its own if you create the right context. Okay, see how that works? So it's completely different. Okay, and again, we could go more into that. How about the metaphor of a digital computer that stores and transfers information as discrete bits of inert data? If we think of human beings as computers, that has implications. Okay, all of these metaphors deserve careful consideration because they all have the power to guide and limit the kinds of educational questions we ask and the answers we give to those questions. Okay, so for example, many arguments for the necessity of annual standardized testing rest squarely on an industrial factory conception of education. Whenever you hear people talking about why we have to have annual standardized testing, what kind of arguments are given? Make sure they know the information. Check on their progress.
Effectiveness of the school.
I'm sorry?
Effectiveness of the school.
The effectiveness of the school. Okay. Did we do this year, did this station this year prepare the student to go on to the next station next year? Did this teacher this year produce the correct amount of widgets that we expect of that teacher in order to enable the products on the line to go on to the next station? Okay? I mean, it makes perfect sense if that's the metaphor that's guiding our view of education. But if we viewed education as a conversion experience, it would make a lot less sense, right? Think about that. I mean, has a pastor ever given a standardized test to, right, check in on day three of the conversion experience or something? That seems very odd, okay? So on a model of education that takes the teacher's goal to be Socratic conversion of the soul or a guided journey of disciples toward mastery, these arguments are much less compelling, right? The arguments for something like standardized tests just don't really make sense. So other questions that are influenced by educational metaphors, the ones that we adopt or reject, include what kind of environment should we cultivate within the classroom? How should schools and teachers structure the daily routines of our students? What kind of assessments, if any, should teachers give? How should we define and evaluate successful teaching and learning? What constitutes valuable teacher training? Right? And I could go on and on. Those are really, really important questions. Right? And what I want us to just think about is the way that we go about answering those questions is profoundly affected by the metaphors that we embrace to understand what we're doing. Okay? The formative power that our metaphors have in how we answer those questions is profound. So analysis of the implications of our educational metaphors is really invaluable, and it behooves us to carefully consider the role that metaphors play in both describing and prescribing our educational thought and practice. Hey, what kind of a teacher do you want to be? What kind of a school do you want to have? I would put forth that we should rely on metaphors that help us to achieve those goals. Okay. Thank you. Let me throw out, we have about 15 minutes left. I'm going to throw out four questions for discussion, and if as sort of jumping off point. And I would love for us to just have an engagement here of conversation as we think about this together, okay? So if you have other questions, feel free to ask those as well. Let me just throw out four questions. Number one, what educational metaphors have you found formative in your own educational practice? Are there metaphors that you have used in your classroom or in your school to affect what you do? And number two, when you think about how your classroom or school functions on a day-by-day or a year-by-year basis, what metaphors do you see at work? Okay, what metaphors for education do you see at work? Or, would it change if I say, what metaphors for education do you see at play? See, even those are both, right? That changes the, what are we doing here? Is this work or is it play? Okay. So when you look at your school or your classroom, what do you see? What metaphors do you see at work? Okay, number three, when you think about how your classroom or school functions on a day-to-day or year-by-year basis, what new metaphors might you use to describe and convey what you're doing? So are there things that you're doing that are really cool in your school that you could rely on certain of these metaphors to help explain why it's valuable? And number four, finally, how can metaphors help you explain to parents and help them understand various educational distinctives of your classroom or your school? Can we use metaphors as a means of helping us to communicate how what we're doing is different than what other schools are doing? Okay, so those are a few jumping off questions. I would love to hear responses to those or other questions that you may have or comments. Yeah, I mean, no, that's a great set of questions. I mean, one thing that pops immediately to mind is what is being expected of teachers, right? How are they being evaluated? What's being looked for? To what extent is there a reliance on sort of quantitative objectives, or to what extent is the ethos of the classroom valuable and important, right? What do the classrooms look like? How are they set up? What kind of activities are allowed or not allowed, right? Is this a place, is this a garden of delight or a factory where the children are sitting at sewing machines, as it were, for hours every day, right? Those kinds of questions are valuable. And so, I mean, I think it is useful. What's useful or maybe unsettling about thinking about these metaphors is that a lot of what we just assume about education is built on certain metaphors. Yeah, anybody have any insights on that? Yeah.
I teach Tennessee until later.
Or that throughout the time here we move from an acorn to a tree whatever, yeah.
And then our school mascot, or whatever you want to call it, is the centurion in reference to...
So you can only have 100 students, or...
Right. Yeah. And then we decimate.
Yeah, that's right. Line up, kiddos. Yeah. So, I mean, a couple other examples I talk about with faculty a lot about us being, and with parents, right, us being a community of learners, right? So I want to talk about what we're doing as a community of scholars and learners living together and working together toward a common goal, right? So if you're the second grade teacher and you're the pre-algebra teacher and you're the you know, senior thesis director and, you know, whatever. Like, you're not isolated in your own little task, right? I want us to think of what we're doing as a community of learners and of scholars working together, right? So the example, you know, the example of having a high school math teacher talk with grammar math teachers about how these concepts connect helps build those bridges. A couple other examples, just from my own experience. One time, just on a whim, I was head of upper schools at the time, and I sent to all my teachers an email. I said, hey, send me a list of all the books that you've read in the past semester, and you can't put on any ones that you've read for class, like nothing in preparation for class. Books you've read on your own, right? A couple were in grad school, others. Okay, I got this list of, it was, 10 teachers at the time, and we got this list of over 50, it was between 50 and 60 books. Okay? And it was everything. It was philosophy, theology, great novels, gardening book, right? I mean, this whole thing. So I just printed it off, alphabetized it, I think, and stuck it on the wall in the upper school. Like, books being read by faculty, right? Well, the grammar, it started all these conversations because the kids are going, who's reading about this or that, right? So it just this very simple piece of papers, the grammar teachers were like, hey, we should do that too. So they did it, right? And we sort of did it every semester or so. We just kind of do it. And it created just a culture in which every time the students walked down the hall, they saw, like, these people, this isn't just a job. Like, this is what they do in their free time, right? Or teachers sitting around the lunch table having a conversation. Or we also, and this isn't possible in all situations, but we made a conscious decision in that situation to not have class bells. We just shut them off, right? So every classroom had an atomic clock that, you know, lined up. And if a teacher went over, the students let them know, right? So we had to be respectful of each other. But it was a very small way of just trying to say, look, we want this learning experience. The students are still moving from classroom to classroom, right? We can't throw everything out. We work within a system. But we want it to feel more organic, right? And less, you know, that's the beginning of class. That's the end of class, right? We want it to feel a little bit more organic and less mechanistic and industrial. So it was a small thing, but I would say it changed the just sort of the ethos of what we were doing. Other thoughts or ideas, questions? Yes, ma'am. It's good. Yeah. Yes.
Conceiving of schools, like, is there a particular one?
I think we mix and match them. Yes. I mean, it would seem to me of the ones we've talked of today that most of our schools are probably aligned much more with an industrial factory model, right, than with the others, in many ways, at least in terms of the way that the routines go. No, that's a very good one too. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, other thoughts? Yes, ma'am. No, I think that's really valuable. And obviously there's time for more specialized meetings or instruction or things like that. But I have been, pretty dogged about, you know, making the grammar teachers sit through deep discussions of philosophy that they're like, what in the world are we talking about? And making the upper school teachers sit through sessions on, you know, gross motor skill development and how the little things that we're doing in first grade with helping children cross over and stuff translates into, you know, synapse development and posture and all these other things, you know, down the road. And they're like, who cares? I just want to go, you know, teach my class. But there has to be that dialogue and that's part of helping to create a community of learners, right? That we're working together. A team would be another, right? That's a sort of metaphor. Yeah. Final thought or question. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming. I hope that this has been useful to just spark your thinking a little bit. And I hope that as you continue here at the conference and then go back to your school, that you would just be aware of this, right? Find yourself saying certain things and go, wait, maybe I should critically think about that. That may not be what I actually want to be doing in terms of the model of education. So thank you very much. Have a wonderful afternoon.